since, we do have a forum on the record. First thing I'd like to do is to take something up out of order. It's a bill that has not reached its committee yet, but it relates to a Mobile Dental Clinic. Pat Platnikoff, who's the president of the Aleut League, or whatever the correct corporation is these days, is here in town in Juneau today to testify on this bill. And since he is in town, he wanted to kind of take this out of order. And we can consider the bill later on because it isn't in the committee yet. So, Pat, would you like to maybe take a seat down at the end? And Al, do you want to have a seat also down there?
Here.
Al, how do you want to work this? Do you want to testify on it briefly or have Pat go ahead?
You want to just go ahead?
Mr. Platnikoff.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing testimony on in support of House Bill 728 this morning. Last evening, approximately about 5:30 last evening, the House HES Committee passed the bill through with a due pass recommendation, and apparently it's on its way up. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to testify on a piece of legislation we believe from the Aleutian Islands and from the Pribilof Islands to be extremely innovative in its approach. And of course, couldn't be more timely because of the serious problems that rural Alaska is facing as far as dentistry is concerned. I based primarily that thought on our experience of last year. It probably comes as no surprise to the committee that dentistry in Alaska, to rural Alaska, is at the emergency stages at this time. Last fiscal year, the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association was able to reprogram some of its dollars within its health programs to strictly dentistry to be provided to the adult population of the Aleutians and Pribilofs. Unfortunately, we were not able to meet all the need, nor were we able to go to all the communities. We reprogrammed $30,000 and was able to visit three communities. And that provided enough capital to have our dentist spend 10 days out in the chain. Because of that experience, the population, or the majority of the population in the Aleutians, began submitting resolutions to the association requesting that we, under the Indian Self-Determination Act, Public Law 93-638, seek out methods and perhaps some ways of trying to take the dental program or have more control in the dental programs that the Indian Health Service is now responsible. We're currently in checking that through the methods that are available to us. This program that we're proposing through House Bill 728, the Mobile Dental Unit Plan, has caused some concern in different parts of the state government. The one thing that we don't want 728 to do, or have not wanted the legislature or the state government to look at it in this fashion, is that we do not want this project to be treated as a threat or an attack on any one group or any one group of professionals. We know most everyone is doing the best that they can under the limitations that they have to operate, and also under the funding level they must operate. What we do want to do is to provide a pilot demonstration project of still perhaps another way of combating the problem of dentistry to be provided to rural Alaskans. This program and this approach has worked elsewhere. It's worked in the Navajo Nation most recently. It's been utilized quite widely in Canada. It's been utilized quite widely in other countries as well. What we hope to accomplish with this MOBI unit, once we have it in place, of course, is after we've had a chance to take care of the serious problems that are existent in the Pribilof Islands and the Aleutians, to make this mobile unit available to other areas throughout the state, as well as a team of dentists that go along with it. With the mobile dental unit that we're designing, we'll be able to move the total working clinic from one place to another and recruit on a timely basis qualified personnel to staff the unit. The reasons for HB 7728, of course, is to request appropriations so that the state of Alaska can assist us in procuring this unit and to also provide funds for transportation. Unless we have the funds through the state, we will not be able to recruit the volunteer dentists to begin work on this project and thus provide the service. Our objectives are to design and build a mobile dental clinic equipped with 3 chairs, also with an x-ray unit that will be equipped with dentists, hygienists, and a supervisor professional staff to ensure that the programs that will be delivered are the highest quality. This approach, and of course the methodology, has been examined throughout this country. Various professional groups have looked at this. It's been studied quite extensively in Canada. And the specialists that we've had discussions with in British Columbia, as well as at the University of California School of Dentistry in San Francisco, recommend unanimously that a mobile dental clinic, which could be moved from place to place, is perhaps the route to go in order to provide quality dental care in rural situations.
Pat, excuse me, if I could interrupt there for a minute. What is it that the $200,000 would be, what would we be getting for that, and how would it be used?
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I...
Fine. Okay, the $200,000, the expenditure there would be a one-time expenditure on the part of the state. A lot of questions was asked of me yesterday evening in the House HES Committee with regard to that expenditure. Are we going to come back next legislative season or next session and sessions after that requesting that the state provide more money? That isn't the case in this regard. The expenditure that we're requesting is a one-time expenditure. $100,000 of that $200,000 will go to direct purchase of and building of the mobile clinic. The additional $100,000 will be utilized, if in fact we do need it, for transportation of that clinic. We're hoping that that will not be necessary.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
You want to go ahead with your presentation, but Mr. Greening did have a question.
Yeah, Pat, it's an intriguing concept. Is the transportation to service all of rural Alaska, is that the transportation element? Or to move this unit to various locales?
Well, the, as far as air transportation is concerned, you'd have to look at the C-130 type of aircraft. But out in the Aleutians Pribilofs, what we've, in some areas, that'll be able to work. Not all airstrips out in the Aleutians are large enough to handle C-130s. With the smaller communities, because, again, because of the extended jurisdiction in fishing, we'll be able to utilize those processing vessels that are within the area, or, you know, sea transport that's more commonly available out there now. And it can be moved to smaller communities without adequate air service.
Well, when you mentioned that you didn't know for sure if the transportation costs would be an annual appropriation, do you mean that perhaps some other entity will pick up the cost there, or what?
The initial thought was that we would probably have to go exclusively to air, but that's not necessary. That's not the case. Transportation costs, we hope to work out with the industry out in the oceans as far as utilizing those processing vessels to transport it. They're, you know, large vessels that work the area nowadays, and we'll be able to utilize those.
How many amendments do you have? Just one?
Is this, okay, the clinic itself is kind of like a unit that you can kind of package up, and this is something that's been done in other states, and people know how to do it.
Yes, sir. We've been working very closely now with Dr. Stark at the University of California School of Dentistry in San Francisco, and he's done this for many years. I couldn't begin to tell you that, but it's quite successful. And it's, you know, very compact, works very well as a total unit.
Okay. Okay, are there further, Mr. Swanson?
Yeah, I apologize for leave for a minute, but was a question asked what impact it would have on the existing Mobile people that work in dentistry now throughout the state?
I think this was, well, one.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it was brought up in hearings yesterday. The Alaska Dental Society, of course, initially had concerns about this and how it might have impact on the use or contracting services that are provided now to rural Alaska through the Indian Health Service. No, it will not have an impact on that, because when we talk about the funds that are available from Indian Health for the Aleutian Islands and most of the rural communities, we're looking at $25,000 per fiscal year. And, you know, that doesn't go very far, so it won't have an impact. It's not this approach or this program is not intended to be in competition with the programs that are now provided. The programs that are available, of course, are very limited in scope, and they only address those needs of the school children.
Then,
it's a unit that you could fly, put in an airplane and fly up the chain. But could it also be put into a Mobile unit to do the highway system?
The unit is a 26-foot mobile home.
Then
it's completely stripped and rebuilt for clinic purposes.
Then it would go to Tok and Delta and Mentasta and anywhere in the highway system, Eagle,
yes,
down
could.
To Kenai.
Yes, it could.
Would it be in, if that were the case, would it be in competition then to a local dentist? I know that we're just now starting to get some dentists into some of the rural communities as this ongoing dentist. Would it have any effect on that type of an operation?
I don't believe so, sir. See, the reason for this, for the conception of this program, of course, is to address the emergency situation that exists out there presently. There are just no dentists. The costs are atrocious, and, you know, the conditions are worsening. And we're not, again, Mr. Swanson, we're not intending for this program to be in competition with existing programs or with existing practices.
In fact, you could use them, I would think that the dentist in private practice, put in certain circumstances, anyhow, use this clinic for addressing himself.
I agree that there's a real need. There's nothing there, but I just wondered if we're just now getting some dentists into rural Alaska, and I just wondered if it would be competition to those dentists, that those areas would be excluded from there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
If I might answer that question further. Mr. Hank Pratt from the Alaska Dental Society was at the hearings yesterday afternoon, and he commented that he did not believe that the Alaska Dental Society would object to this type of program because of our assurances and the fact that we're not trying to compete with the existing programs. As a matter of fact, my comment to Mr. Pratt was such that I was hoping that the Alaska Dental Society might begin looking at ways and means by which better service could be provided to rural Alaska at the cost that could be afforded by rural Alaskans. Now, we recognize we're going to have to work conjunctively with the Indian Health Service in order to do this, but something should be done.
Okay.
Yeah, I just had one question, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned volunteer dentists. Are these dentists licensed in Alaska, or are they Alaskans, or where do the dentists come from? Or do you have them lined up?
Well, we hope to, Mr. Greening, we hope to have 6 volunteer dentists. They're not licensed in Alaska, they're licensed out of California. I was questioned quite extensively yesterday about the licensing procedures, because Alaska doesn't have a reciprocal agreement with any other state as far as dentistry is concerned. They may have it for medical doctors, but not for dentists. The licensing procedures are made available through Alaska statutes. It has to do with the designation of remote areas by the Department of Health and Social Services. Once designation is accomplished, then the American Dental Society or the society should grant or must grant dentists temporary permits for 1 year at a time to practice within the state. And that's provided for in Alaska Statutes 08-36-271. We've gotten, as of the 7th of, or 16th of January, the designation of the Aleutian Islands as an isolated area to qualify for this type of an approach, or to qualify for temporary licensing. And to further answer it, the people that we would have in this program would not just be, they're not students, they're graduates, or in some cases, they're practicing dentists.
If there's nothing else, then I'd like to thank Mr. Kratnikoff for appearing here and testifying on this bill. As I said earlier, we do not have the bill before us at this time. It was reported out of the task committee apparently last night. So we don't officially have it, so we can't take action on it at this time. However, we will come back to the bill, and I appreciate your presentation, Captain, and we will take action on the bill when it's soon to mature. Mr. Meeks.
Mr. Chairman, is this fund for FY79? I see the effective date, but I mean,
the bill,
it's not planned to be utilized until
it takes effect immediately, so they can buy it now, and whatever's left lapses as of June 30th, 79, so it is an FY79 appropriation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. Okay. Is there someone here on the National Council of Alcoholism Appropriation? Okay, I'd like to take that up at this time. House Bill 780. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
All right, House Bill 780, and it's a cause for appropriation supplemental of $50,000, actually special appropriation, $50,000 for the National Council on Alcoholism. There is a memorandum from the National Council in the files, in the bill files. And also, the department's position is included. You'd like to proceed, sir?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Cole. I'm the coordinator of the State Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. We prepared a position paper on this request. We're not the sponsors. I think the position paper speaks for itself. We don't have any objection to the legislature making a decision to continue the funding for this. If there are any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
780. Okay. Ms. Buttall.
Mr. Chairman, we had this on HASS committee, but at that time I didn't get to ask this question. Like, you are in the Office of Alcoholism. What is this is not within your area. What do you do in terms of this kind of activity, in publicizing and writing newsletters, this sort of thing, in your office?
We don't do anything except through organizations like the National Council on Alcoholism and local councils on alcoholism, which they organize down through the years, which we fund. There's some 19 of them throughout the state. Every local affiliate, which includes local councils on alcoholism in Anchorage, Ketchikan, Petersburg, Wrangell, Juneau, Sitka, Dillingham, Fairbanks, Yakutat, Kodiak, Seward, Valdez, Cook Inlet region, Unalaska, Nome, and there are two or three more that I couldn't recall the names of offhand this morning, provide some local prevention efforts in terms of seminars, workshops, presentations on radio and TV for the local community. We have never funded a newsletter or library service through our agency because the National Council on Alcoholism has had that service available. We have always funded them to provide those services in the past, on our behalf, as well as on behalf of the rest of the programs in the state. And I think the one big problem that they pointed out at a recent meeting of the Governor's Advisory Board on Alcoholism in Anchorage last week was that, and you have to realize at the time we made the funding decisions last year, we anticipated that their federal grant would be continued, which has been in the amount of several hundred thousand dollars a year for the past 3 or 4 years. But that they stand to lose the capacity to distribute their films that are in the library there, which we've helped purchase down through the years, of which there is a very extensive library there in Anchorage that's full of films, film strips, tape presentations on alcoholism problems that are used throughout the state of Alaska.
Yeah, Mr. Duncan.
My question is answered.
Okay, this money, is it Dr. Cole?
No, sir.
Okay,
Mr.
Cole, this money, as I understand it, is really necessary to distribute these materials to the places where they need it, and they're essentially alcohol education.
That's correct.
Sort of preventive maintenance, if you want to put it that way.
Well, the films, without going into a lot of elaborate detail, range all the way from being films that are prepared especially for children, very basic kinds of learning, things that could be presented in the classroom, to things that are for adult audiences, so basic educational kind of materials.
Okay. Are there further questions, Mr. Cole, on this bill? Mr. Guy?
Yeah, there's reference to the POSCAC and HUNA. Naposkak is one of my constituent villages.
Right.
Would you please enlighten the committee as to how the program was run?
The Naposkak and Huna were two communities that we had negotiated with the Alaska Native Commission on Alcoholism last year The Alaska Native Commission on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Let me give, if I could, just a brief description of that agency. That's an agency funded also by the federal government, which is made up of Native organizations throughout the state. It has a very broad statewide membership that provides, among other things, regional technical assistance to several different regions. In YK region, there are two, Mr. Pete and Louis Andre. There's a regional technical assistant in the Copper River Native Association Area, one in Southeast, one in Manilik, one in Bristol Bay Native Corporation region, and one other. I think in Norton Sound, but I can't be sure about that. At any rate, their job is to foster and organize alcoholism prevention and treatment programs in the rural communities. They worked very hard last year. In fact, I think it was the best of 3 years that they've had so far in getting communities organized and ready to come in with grant applications if that seemed necessary, which in many cases it did not. Naposkyak is one of two communities that we selected that had asked for a limited amount of funds because the local village council is highly organized, has very strong feelings about alcohol abuse in their village, and does such things, for example, as post a boat on the river. And when people come out of Bethel on their way upriver and they're obviously drunk and the boat's going around all over the place, banging into the banks and so forth, the local council will throw a line on that boat, haul the people into the village, pump them full of coffee, berate and shame them, and give them lots of good advice about not coming back through Naposkyak drunk again. Which we think, because it's a strong local village council, it makes a lot of good sense. They have pretty good control of their own population, too.
I'd like to have you tell me what you do at Fort Yukon.
In Fort Yukon right now, we're not doing anything. We used to have a small grant for counseling services in Fort Yukon that we terminated, I think, 3 years ago. And the reason was that we had some audit problems up there. We had problems with ever getting anybody on the phone to tell us what was going on with the program. Fort Yukon happens to be a community that has a community-owned liquor store and raises about, I could be wrong about the dollar figures, but I think their gross approximates about $45,000 a month off the community-owned liquor store, which is what they use to fund all of their local city services, or virtually all of them. And I'd have to say that my opinion, based upon the evidence I've gotten back from people that I've sent in there and so forth, it's a very badly damaged community, but there doesn't seem to be an organization put together right now that can handle the local effort there. I certainly wouldn't have any objection to funding a program there.
Are you aware that the school has an ongoing alcohol preventing program, and it's funded totally by the association, not the liquor store, but the association? And I think they have repeatedly tried to make contact with the alcohol people, and they're not getting to first base.
Well, it depends on who.
Now, one thing again, at Fort Yukon, what they're trying to do there is to put an education in the schools with the first, second, third, fourth graders, so that the youngsters know what they're doing, and they're not getting to first base on anything with you people on a matching or anything else.
Yes, Jim.
Could I answer, Mr. Swanson?
Yeah.
For just a second. Thank you. I'm not sure who it is they're trying to get a hold of. I'm not aware that, and God knows they may have tried to get a hold of us. They've tried to reach my office in the last 6 months or so. They could easily be trying to reach the National Council on Alcoholism office, which does a lot of local community organizing, or the Alaska Native Commission on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. I could check to see if we have a record of them asking for a grant this year, and if they do, and we get the grant application back in, I can assure you the board will take it up with the others.
That's me.
Mr. Chairman, I might add that we've had the Alcoholism and Drug Abuse BRU up last night. We'll have it up tonight, too. If any members such as Mr. Swanson are interested, they could come tonight. His budget will be up then. He's, of course, now just testifying on somebody else's. But.
Okay. Any further questions on this?
Mr. Chairman, how much amount of monies were granted to the Naposkyak program?
think it was a total of $25,000.
And that went for how long?
12 months.
1 whole year.
Ms. Buckholz. All right, Ms. Buckholz moves and asks unanimous consent to report the bill out. Okay, then we report out House Bill 780. There were apparently no changes made in the Hess Committee.
Mr. Chairman, there was a tendency to increase the amount in Hess Committee, Mr. Chatterton proposed an increase because of the fiscal note that was attached. However, the people involved had requested $50,000 from discussions privately and in testimony, so we did not make any changes.
Okay. Is there objection to the motion to move the bill? If not, the motion carries. How many new passes do we have? Majority of the cast. Next, is Mr. Tellinghast here?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, there you go. Okay. The next matter would be House Bill 588, the repurchase of the Kachemak Bay leases. I think it's safe to say that people understand. Is there anybody here that needs to be have the entire issue explained all over again? We've taken this up, I believe, at least twice. And this is just more of the same. I think everybody has their minds made up one way or the other. If I'm wrong, I want people to speak up now because I'd like to just simply go into the amounts and not into the lengthy history of what the Kachemak Bay lease repurchase is.
The bill number?
And that would be number 588. Okay, Mr. Tellinghast, could you address your remarks just to the amounts of the settlements?
Mr. Chairman, this completes Kachemak Bay lease reacquisition with one small exception, which I'll get to in a moment. The basis for the bargain on the three leases we're dealing with here is the same as the leases that were, the contracts that were presented to the legislature last year. The amounts represent bonuses and rentals paid by the lessees together with accrued interest. It also includes those actual geophysical and geological costs incurred in reliance on the lease. Interest does not accrue on this latter figure. The one lease which is not before the committee now is a minor lease. The lessees were not willing to accept the type of bargain that we offered the remainder of the lessees, and as a result, last summer we filed an eminent domain action against that lessee, and that action's pending. It would probably be inappropriate to make public speculations on the outcome of the amount of money that will be owed, but I think it's safe to say that it will be a small figure. It will be a five-figure amount.
Mr. Rowe.
Who is the party?
Rahoy and Berglund.
Urban.
I believe so.
Urban Wayne Horton. Okay, are the
Mr. Chairman, is this the last of the purchasing or are there more?
Well, Mr. Tellinghast just said that there was one more that they were taking.
Other than the one that we're in litigation with, this completes the package.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, are there any questions on this? Are the figures, Mr. Tellinghast, that appear in House Bill 588, are they correct?
At the point this bill reaches its last committee, we're going to have to, with regards to Texas International and Samasco, make some very minor adjustments in interest because additional interest will have accrued by that time. Inconsequential amounts that can't be determined now. We're talking in the neighborhood of hundreds of dollars at the most. So those changes will have to be made further on, but they can't be made now. With that caveat, yes, sir, correct.
Okay, is there a motion on this bill? Mr. Dunn?
I move the report to file in the ER.
Mr. Duncan moves and asks unanimous consent to report out House Bill 588. Is there objection? There's no objection. Motion carries. I would assume that there are some objectors to the appropriation.
Yeah.
So, but we have any good passage to the game? I think we have a majority of good passage. Okay. Question Road.
How much has been the total of these acquisitions in money?
My pocket calculator isn't with me. The appropriation last year was approximately $14.5 million. The appropriation this year is approximately $7.5 million, so that we have a total of approximately $22 million.
Well, that's less than the state received from us. $25 million.
Well, we also have credits being taken, remember. Shell will be taking approximately $2.5 million.
That's what I mean, the whole
work. Oh, the whole works. I think you have to add $2.5 million in credits from Shell, which will get you up to $24.5 million.
I don't think you have your figures, because there's a certain amount of cash, certain amount of credit, certain amount of interest, which is somewhere around 30 million. Or at least this was the calculation I had in mind. But they didn't give it to me. They were just going ahead with the meeting.
Okay, Mr. Tilley asked, did you supply those
the total figures?
Mr. Lowe?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, what the hell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next matter is House Bill 832. That provides for rebate on individual income tax rates, and Mr. Freeman is the prime sponsor of the bill. Turn the presentation over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could take just a 832 minute to the committee's time, I'd like to give you a little background and history. For the last 4 years, I think four different bills, made an effort to come up with a bill that would reduce the individual income tax, the target year having been from the beginning, 1978. Obviously, that was geared to production from North Slope. My first attempt was what I considered to be a very simple one, an approach, and that was to simply reduce the beginning of 1978 calendar year, to reduce the state income tax by 25%, and the following year in 1979 to decrease it another 50% and leave it at 25% of its current rate. There was a number of my colleagues that thought that was a bit premature, since we were quite some time away from 1978 and we didn't know exactly what the situation was going to be, and there were some objections voiced to the doing it on graduated basis. In other words, people who made the most money had got the most benefits, and that in effect is true, and it violated what I had in mind to begin with, and that was I've taken a position from the beginning that the natural resources of the state of Alaska belong to all the people of Alaska, and that people were, when there was a windfall or an increase in the monetary benefits as a result of those natural resources, that all of the citizens of Alaska were entitled to receive some benefit from that. We have, obviously, since the original $900 million, there has been many benefits gone to the citizens of the state. And I don't quarrel with the worthiness of those expenditures, the cause that they were for. But it doesn't take much investigation to see that there's a certain number of people in the state who have not received any benefit. And I give you some examples. Again, I don't quarrel with the individuals, but there have been great increases since the North Slope oil bonus sale, for instance, in the school foundation program. If you go to look at the school foundation programs, and you find that roughly 70% or better of the money that goes into school costs goes into teacher salaries. Therefore, you know, the teachers have benefited, and I don't quarrel with that, you know, at all. I'm not saying that they were entitled to more money. There are numerous instances. The municipalities and the revenue sharing have, with this year's budgeted amount, will have picked up about $95 million from the Treasury. And you can make the argument that, you know, that the people, the citizens benefit, that's true, but everybody doesn't live in a municipality, in a city that receives revenue sharing. And frankly, and this is beside the point, but frankly, the citizens who reside in municipalities haven't really, in my estimation, shared that much of the benefit from the shared revenue. They've hired more and more people, is what it amounts to. And it's almost universal to all municipalities. The old timers have received a longevity bonus. And again, many of these things that I don't quarrel with, they're worthwhile. But then there's a great number of people, and that is the people who are not school teachers, and not old timers, and they don't work for the city, and they have a job, and they carry a lunch pail, and they pay their income taxes, and they just haven't received it, that much of a benefit. So in an attempt to sort of spread the benefits, so to speak, as soon as we were able to do so, I chose the state income tax as a vehicle because it covers more than any other one category, more people to the state than any other. All right, so to get back then to my first bill, the argument against it was, number one, it was premature. Number two, that it didn't equalize the benefits because using the state income tax, that it was gave the people who made the most money more money, more benefit. And that was actually in violation of what I was trying to do. My contention being that the natural resources, the benefits, therefore, should be equally shared by the rich or the poor. It makes no difference. Your benefit shouldn't be tied to income. And so that I abandoned that one and came back with another try. And this time I thought I had a winner. The argument, and I get a different argument from the Department of Revenue every time I came up with a different approach. So I'd go back and try to solve the objections raised, and that created more objections. But the last time I thought I had a way to do this, I simply got down on the floor with a tape and the scissors and took the income tax scale table and split them in two. And shifted them so that the benefits, the people in the higher brackets would, I chose an amount, I think, of about $600, and I readjusted the percentages and tables so that the guy who made $200,000 a year still paid the same income tax. People who made $150,000, you know, got a little benefit and worked it on down. And till I got down to the people who had a taxable income of $14,000, and they were eliminated. And I thought that I had met the objections of letting the people who made lots of money get off the hook, and the little guy at the bottom didn't get as much. And I was astounded when the report came back, and this is from last year, and I'll read it. It says the Department of Revenue indicates that a total of 180,234 tax returns filed for the calendar year, and 138,299, or 77% of these, had taxable incomes of less than $14,000. So by trying to let the tax burden hang still pretty heavy on the guy at the top and take it off the guy at the bottom, I eliminated 77% of it. You know, it was quite a shock to me. Anyway, last effort last year, Mr. Chairman, was House Bill 523, and I had 30 co-sponsors on that bill, and I it came to Finance Committee and it never moved, and that wasn't your fault, Mr. Chairman. I just didn't, because I recall that you told me that if I wanted to move it, why, it was possible, and I didn't have the nerve to do it because I didn't want to embarrass my co-sponsor. So this year I, trying to find another way around it, I went to ask Mr. Meekins if he would work with me and maybe he could come up with an idea that I'd overlooked, and we'd go have a brainstorming session, go through the whole routine and see if we could come up with a method that would meet most of the objections that I had encountered over the years. And House Bill 832 is an effort to do that. House Bill 832 simply gives each adult that filing an individual income tax a rebate. And that is, if you have $100 taxes, well, you get a credit of $100, therefore your tax liability for that year is zero. And this seems simple enough, and the arithmetic seems simple enough. Again, we have complications, but the arithmetic, again, going back in the department, could furnish us no figures other than the 180,234 tax returns. We took a percentage, asked the staff to analyze that and figure out what the percentage of those were part-time. And in the bill, down about line 26, it's prorated. If you pay half your income tax in Alaska, you only get half the credit type thing. And so that's about where we stand. I would, one thing I should say, Mr. Meekins and I were only able to get this bill in on the last day of the individual filing, and we don't claim that there's that it's perfect by any means, but at least we wanted to get it in and get it before the committee and have an opportunity to explain what it does and what we were trying to do. And we have a difference of opinion between, as I always seem to have with this bill, is to difference of opinion is actually what the not the cost, I suppose that's one way to put it, the cost, but the decrease in income to the state would amount to. Again, going back and using the figures, Mr. Meekins and I and the staff assumed that since they were talking about 180,000 individual income tax returns, and that we have a percentage figure of those that are half-time, we ended up with about 15, what we figured to be 150,000 full equivalent credits, which would, the cost would have been $15 million. However, when the department, Mr. Jenkins from the Department of Revenue, they came in with their analysis of the bill, and it's quite different. I think everybody has a copy of this in their file, and reasonably easy to understand. They maintain the way they arrive at it. They come up with 283,000, which would be the cost, would be again within 28,300,000 in reduction of state income. So somewhere, and then we had, and then Mr. Barker went back and had a look at it, and again, did you pass this one out? No, it isn't everybody's file. And there's his analysis of it. So I suppose that briefly, if I can do it, Mr. Chairman, that's what it's about.
I got a question about the two tables that were prepared by Legislative Affairs Agency. One of them is, appears to be, it's the same scenario with and without the tax rebates, right? These two charts, okay. And it doesn't seem to affect the permanent fund contribution. Okay. Are there questions by the members of the committee? Clearly, this is a very major piece of legislation. We're not going to move on it this morning, but I think initially, the concept that we need to familiarize ourselves with, and of course it has to be integrated with a lot of other things, including the revenue picture and the permanent fund, and also any sort of major surgery that people want to take on things like revenue sharing. I think it's an approach that may well supplant and take the place of the suggested changes in municipal revenue sharing. It's something we believe that enough is enough along that line. Mr. Meek?
Mr. Chairman, all the information we have indicates that this form of trying to distribute the wealth that we have from our resources back to the public is what the public really wants. All the polls indicate that they'd rather have a tax rebate or some sort of income tax change rather than have payments from Alaska Inc. or any other kind of proposal that's been put forth so far. And that's one of the reasons that I support it, because by far it's the highest percentage of people would like this kind of an action to take place. Also, there are some possibilities for changes. The information that the staff generated is quite different, as Mr. Freeman pointed out. We're talking about 150,000 persons getting a rebate as opposed to 283,000. So it's a tremendous jump in the numbers. And I suppose we'll have to find out what the real facts are. And if it is larger than our estimate, we may want to make some changes that are possible. For instance, right now, under our current language, the bill would give a person $100, even if their total tax liability was only $20, they'd still get $100 back, or even if it was zero, they'd get $100 back. We could make an adjustment and say that you, in no case can you receive more in the rebate than your tax liability, and this may have an effect on it. There are other possibilities such as that to reduce the loss of revenue to the state.
I'd like to bring up perhaps one thing that we might want to explore. There was at one point a study going on to determine how much it would cost to cover Alaskans who aren't otherwise covered for medical benefits beyond a certain point. What I'm talking about, of course, is catastrophic medical expenses that might occur. I wonder if it might be in order to integrate that also, perhaps on a voluntary basis. In other words, maybe the taxpayer could opt whether he or she wants to receive a rebate, or whether they want to be covered under a statewide medical plan. I don't know whether it's practical or not. It might be something that we could explore.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meekins and I considered a lot of possibilities, and it was sort of more or less, I suppose he went along because it was my wishes, but I wanted to start with this thing as uncomplicated as I could possibly make it. I wanted people to understand if we were able to get the thing passed, you know, exactly what it was and what we were doing. And so there was no question in anybody's mind that we were allowing them to have part of their money back to do with it as they wish. And for that reason, in the beginning, we decided to present it in its present form. And again, there, as Mr. Meekins has said, there may be some, there are some amendments or some changes that we can make to meet some objections that might arise. But basically, as far as I'm concerned, and as we talked this over, as far as we're concerned, it's more or less a policy decision, whether this is the thing we want to do. And the rest of it, again, if it's a matter of mechanics of how we get more about it. But that was one reason that we didn't have anything else on it. We wanted people to understand what it was all about.
Mr. Meekins, and Mr. Rose.
Mr. Chairman, speaking to that question of the policy, in addition to the reason, which I think is an excellent reason, that people want this kind of a procedure as opposed to Alaska Inc. or some other kind of procedure, and I think we should respect their wishes. There's a pretty firm economic principle that states if you're gonna give people money, you ought to let them spend it.
because they know best how to spend their own money and how to get the most benefit out of it. And I think that's what the concept is here. If you took the same amount of money and said, well, we want to distribute these benefits back to people, so we're going to increase revenue sharing, what we found, even though we've demanded that they reduce the property rates or something like that, it never happens. What happens is the people still pay increased taxes to the municipality, and the municipality takes the money and spends it on maybe more local employees or more government services even, but the individuals never really receive an increase in spendable income. They don't receive that. And I think we've seen that in a number of ways. And that's why we're moving towards these other ideas where they receive direct cash payments. But of all the ones suggested for direct cash payments, this is by far the most popular. And I think it's fair in the sense that it's based upon those people that pay taxes are the ones that receive the benefits. And there's an element of fairness.
I think there's a lot to be said for the simplicity of the idea.
It's simple, Mr. Chairman, in the respect that it's just one additional line to the, as I envision, one additional line to the tax form. After you've made all your tax calculation, at the end it says Alaska, you know, non-renewable resource rebate or Freeman rebate, whatever you want to call it.
And, swing the camera around.
And
there.
You take $100 off or $200 off or $300 off, depending upon which year it is. And it's very simple in that respect.
Are there persons from the Department of Revenue who are prepared to comment on this proposal at this time? Are other persons from the administration who are prepared to comment or wish to comment on this proposal?
Mr. Chairman, I might make a
comment. Mr. Messenger.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to point out this provides a fairly simple bill of providing a direct tax rebate beginning in 1978 of $100 first year, $200 the second year, and $300 for the third year and following years. In short, I guess our position is that we're opposed to this bill, basically because of the revenue that we represent. Our estimates show a reduction of revenues of $28.3 million in for FY79, $56.6 million in 1980, and $84.9 million in subsequent years. I see Milt Barker has estimated a different number of number of rebates, and for the first year that would amount to $27 million as opposed to $28.3 million. So there's probably some flexibility, but I think probably you're talking within $5 million the amount of rebate to rebate revenues for each of the years. I just might make one other comment in terms of in the committee's deliberations of the bill. I think possibly that this bill might require an accompanying appropriation. The bill provides a specific requirement of a payout of the Treasury of a certain amount per individual. And I think there may be a state constitutional requirement for an appropriation to do that. It's not actually changing the tax liability or the substantive tax laws. It's just a payment requirement. So that's just something I think people might want to take into account.
John, there's now a measure pending before the Senate that would require the multinational corporations essentially to pay income tax, corporate income tax, at the same rate as Alaskan corporations do. As you know, because of their accounting systems, they don't do that here in Alaska. If that measure were to pass, there would be a substantial impact upwards on the state's revenue picture. If that bill were to pass, would the Department of Revenue support this type of approach?
Well, it would, you know, certainly offset the decrease here, but I think we would still be opposed to it in terms of the reliance on more substantial portion of our reliance on non-renewable resources as a percentage of the state spending.
Well, doesn't that boil down to saying that you have to tax the people instead of the multinational corporations who are here engaged in resource extraction?
Well, all persons in businesses pay a share to the support of government services, to some extent when we start receiving incomes from the permanent fund, that might be the appropriate time to make those sorts of adjustments. But at this beginning stage, the flows of revenue from the pipeline, I think it's premature.
Well, let me. I don't mean to infer that there's any kind of any connection between the two bills. That's not right. And what I'm getting at is that if you had the extra revenue going into the state treasury from one source or another, would the department have a problem with this type of approach? I know that we're just starting on the bill, but would the department have a problem with the approach except for the revenue problem?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't have a problem. I mean, not this specific approach. Although, again, there might be a problem in terms of the question of how much reliance is placed on non-renewable revenues as opposed to renewable revenues. And I guess that's all I can say at this point. I guess I'd have to come back to the committee later in terms of, studying that question more.
Yeah, I understand. It's a very major piece of legislation. Mr. Meekins, then Mr. Swanson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I understand Mr. Messenger's concern about reliance on non-renewable resources income. And I think we've addressed that question in regards to the permanent fund and the renewable resource development fund. Those are attempts to switch our economy over to a renewable resource base. And I think that's the answer to that solution. I mean, that's the answer to that question. The answer is not to increase the amount of taxes that we take from the general public so that the percentage that we rely on oil taxes is less. I think what we want to do is use the money that we receive from the development of oil, particularly that the state owns, that all the people the state own in common, use that money to do several things. One, distribute the benefits back in the terms of something like this, a rebate, where they get some of the benefit from the extraction of that oil, because once it's gone, they're not going to get anything. So I think they need to get it while it's happening. And secondly, take some of the surplus and try to generate a renewable resource-based economy so that after the oil is gone, we still have an economy that can support itself. And I think that's the way to address yourself to the question of reliance too much on oil taxes. If the other way, I think, really begs the question. You say, well, let's increase taxes on people or decrease taxes on the oil company. And you've got one of the other ways of doing it. I mean, that to me isn't a good solution.
Mr. Swanson.
Yes. What percent we base our state income tax on a percentage of what we pay the federal? What is that percentage now?
Well, we have our own tax rate schedule, but it's approximately 16% of the federal tax rates in 1963. So it's probably a bit more.
It hasn't been changed. 16%. In his question, then, Mr. Chairman, when he said we would have to go to a direct corporation and we may have a problem there, rather than you use the money up in moving it around, then we could achieve the same thing by just dropping that percentage.
We would not have to go to appropriation, still the taxpayer would arrive at that benefit.
Well, I would think that you could cover the appropriation question pretty easily, because you can just do it right in the budget every year. That would show up, of course, as a large increase in public spending, which you have to make clear to the public what's going to them. But mechanically, I don't see that there's any problem. You can estimate, as we do in many other areas, what the appropriation should be, and then maybe we'll have to come back the following session and adjust it. But I think mechanically, we can handle it okay. Thank you, Mr. Messenger, and we understand that this is by no means the last word, but I appreciate your initial reaction.
I have a question. It's in regard to the. There's a couple of differences in the. Mr. Humphreys did our estimates, and of course Revenue did theirs, and there's a couple of differences, and one of the main ones is that they estimate 283,000 individuals would be eligible for this rebate. We estimated about 150,000. So one of the questions I have, we took 75 and used that as a base, but I was wondering where they get the projection, because in 1977 we got the information from the Department of Revenue showed $210 million in income taxes from individuals, and then in 78 there's a revised estimate down to $135 million. So there's a tremendous drop in individual receipts from individuals, which obviously is due to the shutdown of the pipeline, or the wind down from the pipeline. So we go from 210 to 135. That's dollar figures, but it must indicate also a reduction in number of individuals, it seems to me, and I'm wondering if you agree with that.
Yeah, it's a combination. I mean, there is a reduction in revenues and a reduction in
number of people
filing. Although,
well, did you consider that in this one?
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen Bill Barker's plan, which approaches it in a different way in terms of just taking population.
Right.
Population and
assuming that everybody eligible would apply, whether they would pay taxes or not.
Right, because as I understand the bill, people are eligible for the rebate even though they didn't file a return in previous years, didn't have income. Every adult person would be entitled to rebate. So it's actually more than the returns filed.
Right, but if we had a provision, if we changed the bill, for instance, to say that you can't receive any more rebate than your liability, then only those people would apply that had some tax liability. And in addition, we'd be saving $50 here and there on people that would apply anyway, but would file taxes anyway, but was going to get $50. Would that make a substantial reduction in your estimate?
It would make some reduction, although I off the top of my head, I don't know how much.
Well, I mean, what I'm getting is that seems to be the difference between our projection and your projection, because you've considered, I think rightfully, the fact that it would be an incentive for people to file who would not otherwise file. No?
Mr. Barr? I believe part of the difference between the research projection and the other ones was that they may not have taken into account that joint returns would receive two tax credits. The bill specifically provides for that.
Did Mr. Hunter's reply?
I think that might be true.
So is it last one?
So there's several things. The one thing that would do is if you cut out that portion of people who don't have any income, then again you're cutting out those people at the very low end of the income.
Mr. Joe, could we ask if Mr. Humphreys could, and I know we're going to have to leave here in a minute and bring this up later, but
perhaps Mr. Humphrey could get with them and try to reconcile some of these questions, and also we'd put forth some alternatives and see, throw them into the work and see what kind of changes we get in projection and process that.
Yeah, I think we should have those runs done.
Sure.
That's one thing that Mr. Meekins and I considered, and again, was whether or not somebody should, if they had no liability, whether or not, again, we weren't too sure. And again, this is why we loaded up this way and get some help and guidance from the committee. And so we're not, neither one of us are really hung up on that particular phase.
Jim?
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if I could return quickly to the administration's objection to an increasing reliance upon non-renewable resources. It seems to me that a good part of the income and other consumer taxes are not, quote, renewable, and that it would swing up or down with the level of non-renewable taxation and then spending through the budget.
And also oil company activity, I'd say. Mr. Chairman, I didn't get into this one, and I'm not going to start now because when it was first brought up, I only had about 15, 20 minutes left, and that's not enough time for me to discourse on my philosophy on rebutting that argument. But it was my assumption, I think you said at the beginning, that we weren't going to take action on this today. So I'll have time to make the arguments, but this is one that I, an approach that I have a very strong feeling as far as in opposition to this argument, and I have the arguments prepared. I've made them enough. I have memorized them.
Okay. Well, let's get these new runs now.
Just a point of information. How are we going to show in the budget the amount of money that we will be, I don't know whether you call it paying back, or where will we show that credit related to the reserves tax? That comes out of the revenue sources over the time of repayment, doesn't it?
Yeah, that doesn't show in the budget. That's just a direct reduction of the amount of the oil company's tax liability. So it just reduces the revenue side and doesn't show.
How would that be shown in a report?
Well, I mean, we could provide that information. Essentially, it's about almost, except for Cook Inlet production, it's almost exactly one half of the severance tax liability. I mean, it's the equivalent of what they're paying. They get a credit for their reserves tax up to 50% of their liability. So what they're paying is actually paying this is 50% of their liability. So if you just double that, that gives you the total gross liability. But if we could provide you with that specific information, if you're
when do they start paying that back?
They're taking credits right at the present time on a monthly basis, and they'll continue to do that for about between 4 and 5 years. It'll all be used up.
$113,000 more.
Right.
I'd like to have that information.
Yeah, so would I.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we'd be available to work with the legislative staff in coming up with some agreeable estimates on this bill. That's agreeable.
Yeah, I'd like to encourage that. So you got the same constants going anyhow. You may not come out with the same numbers at the tail end, but at least you can make the same general assumptions when you make the computer run. All
right.
Huh?
Okay. I would ask Mr. Freeman and Mr. Meekins to let us know when you're ready to go again on that. Okay. Red. Before we go away here, are you ready to go with natural resources
later?
Well, I think we've got meetings tonight.
Tomorrow night? What is tomorrow?
I was thinking in terms of Friday.
one night.
Yeah, except in the morning.
Do it in the morning. I got it.
Hey, can we meet it Thursday night? Because I had a conflict already.
No. Can we do it in the morning?
Well, tomorrow morning? Saturday. If we got enough time.
I'm going to be gone Saturday.
I want to be sure.
That's right. You've got a campaign.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm telling you, I'm finding it goddamn distressingly hard to keep up with this subcommittee system the way it's working. You know, stick.
When we broke last night, we were taking up the Fairbanks campus, rather Anchorage campus appropriation, and I think we barely touched on it, really. One of the things that was addressed was what I took to be the most serious thing that we took up yesterday was the $1,350,000 omission for the operation of the new building there on the Anchorage campus, which of course there's no question about the fact that we have to add those items to the budget. We have, once again, Dr. Wolf and Dr. Stan Braun, okay. Somebody once told me that was good enough for any man, but you never know. Okay. Dave, what were we doing? What did we aim on?
There was no specific spot in the UA budget, Mr. Chairman. We had been talking about income, and we had been talking about the academic development plan, and I think that's the point that we saw.
Okay.
Do you have something up, Mr. Chairman, that may help the committee follow some of the discussion?
Anything that will help the committee follow. It
may help the follow.
Deeply appreciate it.
Yesterday, the university referenced, at the chairman's request, how much of their current workload program was included in the $70.8 million. The university told us to look at page 3 of the thin book, which place it had items numbered, and said these are the items that are in the $70.8 million figure. This is the listing that they were referring to. This lists all of the workload increases by priority, by unit of the university, that are included in the budget.
What page is it on?
In the thin book, the thin yellow book, the first one they gave us, page 4 through 6 of the first section of pages. Identify, references items. For example, Fairbanks references items 6, 7, 12, 16, and 17.
Now,
those item numbers are listing, it's in the list I just gave you. So it's a separate document.
Are these items plus the FY79 current services equal maintenance?
Yes. All of these items together with current services would equal maintenance. In addition, the university is trying to identify for us those items which they have placed in the $70.8 million governor's figure above current services. Only some of these are in that low figure.
Okay.
And those are the ones that are identified on page 4 through 6.
So it's their position, the governor's figure is less than maintenance.
That's right. So when they reference some of those current service figures, you can find them in this package.
Incidentally, I would have, at about 1:30, the Ketchikan delegation from the city of Ketchikan had asked to make a presentation to the committee, and Mr. Freeman's asked if we accord that delegation, not the legislative delegation, but people from the city of Ketchikan, the privilege and test of addressing the committee, and I said that would be appropriate. Also, Willie Hensley has matter that he'd like to address that relates to the allegations made the other day about the Nana Corporation. The Nana Corporation feels that they should respond to that, so it's only fair that they'd be allowed to do so. So we may have about a 30-minute hiatus here at 1:30, for which I apologize, but things are just going too thick and fast here, and some things we just have to address. Okay. This, just so Dave, tell me what the title of this thing is.
Okay. This document identifies all of the items that the university has included in as in its document in the big and fat book as workload increases. It has them all identified by unit, and it has them in priority order within each unit.
All right, that would be beyond the 70.8 level?
No. This would, it would be beyond the current services level. You recall in Form 5 as in
right.
Right. Okay.
So what is the current services total now?
Earl, do you know what the current services total is?
69.7.
69.7, is that about right?
Probably to help Dave to orient people to the document, you know, you passed out, would be to go back in the smaller yellow book on page 3.
The first page 3?
The first group of pages on page 3. And if everyone is on that page, if you'll look up in the upper third of the page, you'll see the figure 71,515.3, which is the answer, Mr. Chairman, to your question. And then looking down below, you can see the way that we adjusted that downward to the 70.8.
Well, I think what the chairman was asking is, what is the amount you've identified in the budget as current services total?
I see that 71.5.
All right.
That's a revised current services.
Well,
if you look on the page 2, we got 69.7.
In the fat book, it's a different figure. That's our problem.
So these are really make up the difference between the 71.2 and 77.4, is that correct?
No.
These pages that you just gave.
No, that's why. I want to make sure we're asking the question the same way. That the document I just gave you makes up the difference between approximately 69.7 and 77.4. The 69.7 is the current services that was originally identified.
Okay,
right.
I think we might as well go into this, and my apologies for this, but it just can't be helped. There's only so many hours in the day, and these things have to be addressed. I would think we'd be 15 to 20 minutes. So just bear with us. Mr. Hensley is here from NANA, and I'd like to ask Willie to address whatever remarks he thinks are appropriate to the statements that were made by Mr. Spray here about a week ago about NANA.
Could I have Mr. Blake on?
Yes.
I would like to introduce Lee Blake, who's with Nana Panties. And I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I I did receive a copy of the transcript at which time there was a discussion about a contract that Dana Mannings had with the State Department of Administration at the Anchorage Pioneers Home, and also a consulting contract we have at API.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Swanson.
I think that Willie should identify himself for the record, so we'll know who's talking here on the tape.
Okay. Fine.
I'm Willie Hensley. I'm president of Nana Development Corporation. and Nana Management is one of the vendors that we operate. And Mr. Chairman, I might add that Nana had been in the catering business in a company called Nana Commercial Catering. And we had done some contracting along the pipeline, but we realized that once the pipeline shut down, there was going to be a more competitive environment in the food service business, so we joint ventured with a company that had long experience in the food service business. And the point I would like to make today is that the allegations that were made by the members of Local 71 or representatives of Local 71 were inaccurate, and I didn't want the committee to be left with the impression that that we were ripping off the state, or that we were not making any real savings to the state, or that the service that we were providing for the state was not up to standard. And what I have is really a short report on what we do for the state, because I do believe that the administration should have the option under certain circumstances to contract with private companies to provide services. I think there are ways that the state can save a lot of money and also get a better product. And I have a small report I'd like to give to the committee members. Mr. Blake works with us very closely with Nana Mannings, and he may have a couple of comments to give to your committee in rebuttal to some of the comments that were made on the 3rd of March.
All right.
Can I make my comments, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please, Mr. Blake.
My name is Lee Blake, and I represent Mannings, and I work with the Nana Group, and as a part of the joint venture Nana Mannings, headquartered in Anchorage, I'd like to address myself to some of the comments that were made on the 3rd of March by Mr. Sprague. One of the points brought up relative to the management services at the dietary department at the API facility in Anchorage was that we effect a labor reduction based on the fact that we changed the method of service to the patients in that hospital. That fact's not accurate. We actually effected a substantial labor savings based on good management principles. The statistics per se are that originally when we made our study back in March of 77, there were currently 32 FTE employees in the dietary department. An FTE, for terminology, is a full-time equivalent. We have, through good management principles, reduced that to 20 FTEs, savings of 12 employees. It was stated that the contractor would save 35 employees by implementing our management principles. In fact, there weren't 35 employees totally in the department. It was also said that we eliminated the dietitian, which is vital to the accreditation of the hospital. This is not so. There was a dietitian department head that terminated her services to go into the real estate business, and we replaced that person by hiring a consulting dietitian at considerable less cost than what the state had previously experienced. It was also said that the food that we were serving at API was not nutritional. Well, first off, the food that's being served at API is being purchased through state channels, and whatever the state's purchasing is what we're preparing. Plus, it's also being prepared by the local 71 cooks. So it's what they're producing, and it's what the state's procuring. Another point relative to the Pioneer Home in Anchorage was that the local 71 estimated that they would need 46 employees to effectively manage the housekeeping and the dietary department. We performed what we call a survey or a walkthrough, and we estimated that we could operate that facility when it was full of residents with about 37 FTEs. To date, after we've been in operation for 7 months, we currently have employed 28 employees on premise. And when the operation is full of residents, which we estimate to be about 133, we'll probably have between 30 and 33 FTEs on staff, which is below our previous estimate of a year ago. What this translates in dollars and cents, something tangible that you can put your finger on, using the projections that were used by Local 71, they estimated using their labor staffing that your annual cost would annualize out to $800,700. We have a signed contract which says we will not exceed $642,500. And that represents the savings of $164,500. To date, if we take the figures we've incurred 7 months to date, it appears that we'll be below that projected budget of $642,500. It was also stated that to affect our management expertise and savings that we brought in five or six people from the lower 48. Not so. We brought in one key management person that affected most of the programs that we implemented at the Pioneer Home. It was also stated that the employees' morale at API was low. Well, I have no way of assessing that, whether it's low or not, but they're being supervised by Local 71 supervisors through our resident consultant. It was also stated that we're not providing the residents at API with butter and grade A meats. The implication is that we're not producing or providing good quality food for the residents, when in fact we are still working out of part of the initial inventory that was procured by the state prior to our assuming that contract. So what we're producing is what they previously had. We traditionally don't use butter in most of our retirement projects. We operate about 40 of them on the West Coast because of health reasons. We find margarine is lower in cholesterol and is more of a benefit to one's diet. However, we offer either to the residents. The full impact of our program really hasn't been felt at either of these facilities because we haven't really implemented our complete purchasing program. Mr. Chairman, I think that about covers my comments.
Mr. Chairman, I might add that one of the reasons I wanted the opportunity to speak to this committee was because I didn't want you to be misled by those particular remarks, and I also didn't want to see the potential or the opportunity for further contracting in this particular field shut off because you didn't have the facts. So I appreciate the time.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Mr. Hensley, Mr. Blake. Glad to hear the other side of the story. Are there any questions by the members of the committee on this matter? Okay, if not, thank you very much. We have with us today a large group of citizens from Ketchikan. And there was no connection.
Just a reporter.
Besides serving some of us a pretty good meal last night, I think that they want to address us on some matters of concern to Ketchikan. Ron Witte is here as a spokesman. And Ron, if you could introduce the delegation and then tell us what you think we ought to hear.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ron Winnie, President of the Chamber of Commerce in Ketchikan, but the delegation we have visiting the Capitol this week is comprised of both the Chamber of Commerce, the City of Ketchikan, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District. I'll try and catch everyone starting in that corner there. Also, participating in our group, of course, is the City of Saxman, the Cape Fox Corporation, the Regional Native Corporation, and we've also, in various discussions earlier this week, had some participation from the mayor of Metlakatla. But starting with Frank Seymour, who many of you might be familiar with, the Cape Fox Corporation, Dale Miller, Chamber of Commerce, particularly in regard to transportation issues, Paul Wingren, also with the Chamber, Assistant City Manager, City of Ketchikan, Jim Adultvorst, Mrs. Wingren in the corner, Borough Manager, Ketchikan Gateway Borough, Judy Slager, Jack McBride, City Councilman, Helen Finney, City Councilman, Sally Smith, member of the Chamber. I guess that would be it. We've also some members, Dean Trout in particular, City Councilman, or Vice Mayor, I guess, of Saxman, and Chairman of the Board of Cape Fox Corporation.
Ron, you might mention, for some of the people that don't know, the City Councilman of Ketchikan also serve as the Borough Assemblyman, right. So they have a dual role.
Many of us wish that was the case. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I would like to kind of review some of the issues that are of particular concern to the community of Ketchikan and the general area, including Metlakatla and Saxman. We have met this last 2 days in particular with various members of the Hammond administration. We just finished election with the governor. We also met this morning with the Senate Finance Committee, and we certainly appreciate you taking your time from the easy matters of the university. I see some few familiar faces. One appropriate fact, I noticed the lights went out as I came in. The first item on my list is to address the hydroelectric support in Southeast. People of Ketchikan and certainly the whole Southeastern community is very much concerned about the development of hydroelectric